coming slapper. It's the subject is the movement for national efficiency, 1880 to 1914. So we'll have the talk first, and then afterwards we'll have announcements, and after we'll have a discussion and debate session. Okay.
Thanks very much. Some of the talks earlier in this series have focused on working class movements and different stages in the development of working class ideas, and working class organisation. But in contrast to that, this week, we're going to be looking at a stage in the development of the strategy used by the ruling class to maximise their exploitation of the majority in society. Now, in doing this, it's important to remember that at every stage, as the ruling class developed its strategy, it was responding, by and large, to actions by the working class. And in some cases, they perceived to be the future dangers of action by the working class. And in that sense, it's worth noting that the class struggle is in fact an interactive process, as the two classes which are in conflict in society actually develop their own ideas and their own actions. Now, in recent years in Britain, we've been seeing the gradual dismantling of the so-called welfare state to a large degree. Although most of the provisions in question were established in the years immediately following the Second World War, in fact, the thinking behind most of these provisions, and indeed some of the earliest such measures of social insurance, can be dated to the period of the Liberal governments in the years just before the First World War, specifically 1906 to 1914. One or two examples of this in particular: the National Unemployment Insurance Scheme, which was started in 1909 by the Liberal government, and the earliest provision of old age pensions, which dates from 1908, again under the Liberal government, which provided for a very limited range of pensions, 5 shillings a week for those over 70, with many restrictions upon the conditions for receiving such a pension. Nevertheless, it can be seen that those basic key examples what is commonly referred to as the welfare state did not in fact begin under the Labour government of post-war Britain. They began essentially in the pre-World War I Liberal governments. My main purpose this afternoon in exploring this area is to demonstrate that in a very large degree these measures were devised as palliative efforts in order to placate working class discontent and in order to promote a smooth and efficient exploitation of the working class, rather than being a serious attempt to change society. And the idea that those kinds of reforms could in some way contribute to a radical change in society is a misconception which grew up in later years, as many on the left misguidedly attached themselves to such notions. But in looking at how they originated, we'll see the way in which they were truly devised and the purpose for which they were properly designed. Now, in order to understand the background to the situation in Britain in 1880 and onwards, it's necessary to take a very cursory glance at some of the economic conditions which existed at the time and some of the economic roots of change in the late 19th century. What we saw, of course, as is well known, throughout the 19th century is a particularly rapid development in the productive forces. The rate of growth of industrial production in the 19th century, needless to say, far outstripped the rate of growth in previous centuries. The rate at which new machinery was being developed, again, was unsurpassed. And even the actual growth of labour itself, in terms of the numbers of modern wage workers, again, growing extremely rapidly. This, together with the development of modern communications, led to a number of things. Firstly, it led to greater expectations on the part of the working class, so that by the end of the 19th century, many workers were beginning to understand the potential for wealth creation and, of course, wealth consumption as well. But at the same time, it produced greater than ever contradictions within society. Let me quote on this issue from somebody called R. Ensor, who was writing in 1912 in defence of a legal minimum wage, in a journal called the 19th Century magazine. He said, "A working class, the poorest members of whom can get from newspapers and cinematographs a vivid idea of the country's wealth and how it is at present spent, must be less and less content with what contented its forefathers. The only question is whether in its strivings upward, it is on the whole to be cool in temper, clear in vision, constructive in method, or hot, blind, and destructive. What we also saw in the late 19th century, in contrast to the first 80 years of that century, was a relative economic decline, a relative slowing of growth in the last 2 to 3 decades of the century. There were, in fact, recurrent economic crises throughout the last 20 years of the 19th century. And this threw a further contradiction into the situation and provoked even further thought about the way ahead for society, particularly on the part of the capitalist class. Also during this period, there was an increasing military expansion of the centralised German state, which after all had only really been created as a unified state in the late 19th century, and the rapid development and militarised development of other states, including, of course, the industrialisation of the federal United States of America. What was rapidly realised by the British ruling class was that the scale of capitalism in the 20th century demanded greater central coordination from the state. And this was by no means a radical or pro-working class idea of state intervention to promote the development of capitalism. Now, there are a number of reasons why, at the end of the 19th century, the capitalist class began to become fearful. Several reasons why they became particularly concerned about the dangers of working class organisation. Firstly, the widening franchise. In a previous talk in this series, we examined this in greater detail. Let me just quote briefly one example of reactions to a gradually widening franchise in Britain. On the subject of the 1866 Reform Bill, Robert Lowe, MP, opposed in these terms: "The working men of England, finding themselves in a full majority of the whole constituency, will wake to a full sense of their power. They will say, we can do better for ourselves. Don't let us any longer be cajoled at elections. Let us set up shop for ourselves." Secondly, the increasing role of education. Foster's Education Act of 1870 was seen as essential in order to have a fully trained modern working class capable of running the capitalist administrative and technological machinery. But of course, from the capitalist point of view, there was a concomitant danger in educating the workers, because the more they were educated, the more they would be able to use that education for purposes other than running capitalism. Indeed, possibly for the purpose of organising to get rid of it. Thirdly, the urban population density, also increasing rapidly throughout this period, led in particular to the possibility of a spreading of disease from poorer to richer parts of London. Now, in present context, this may seem a slightly odd observation, but the fact is that throughout the earlier part of the 19th century, the working class and capitalist class parts of London were far more ghettoised and separated off from one another than they were to become later on, and indeed than they are today, far more intermingled in many cases than they were then. And so, in fact, many of the epidemics which were very closely related to poverty were sufficiently removed from the capitalist class not to be of particular concern. When, however, the increase in population density, the increase in rapid communications and transport, meant that there was a slightly more physical intermingling between the classes, there was suddenly a rather selfish panic on the part of capitalists that if workers were allowed to have their epidemics of poverty unchecked, that this might start to actually literally infect capitalists. And this indeed was an issue often written about at the time. The fourth concern of the capitalists in this period was military. There was a need to provide a killing machine with healthy recruits. The culminating point at which this was realised was at the turn of the century, the Boer War. This saw many potential recruits having to be turned away for reasons of ill health and general debility. For example, in Manchester, an incredible 8,000 out of 11,000 volunteers had to be turned away through their state of poor health, and the fact that in many cases, if they were admitted with infectious diseases, for example, these would rapidly spread through the troops. So a majority of recruits were in such a bad shape that they had to be turned away. This clearly was food for thought for the capitalist class. Further to all of this, on a broader level, there was possibly a loss of confidence in the ideas of free market liberalism, which had dominated the middle years of the century. Again, this would have been provoked partly from growing competition from other newer states, such as Germany, Italy, and even France and the United States, some of which, particularly Germany, were relatively centralised and therefore were able to organise their own productive targets more effectively. Now, the final and perhaps for us most important reason for fear on the part of the capitalists was the working class itself, of course. And therefore we need now to look at the working class and the stages of working class resistance that have developed through history. If we go back to the very earliest stages of the late Middle Ages, we find that the first form of working class resistance was basically that of crime, destruction of machinery, simple robbery. These, in fact, could be said to be forms of resistance against an oppressive system. Many cases of riot and arson, the famous cases of the Luddites, for example. This was largely disorganised, relatively isolated, and therefore not of any great long-term effect in liberating the working class. It was simply a thrashing out in the dark. The next clear stage in working class development, it could be said, is that of trade unionism, again developing to some extent much later. And the trade unions prior to the late 19th century were rather limited and somewhat exclusive organisations. They were craft-based, in other words, they were organised strictly in terms of precise skills involved, rather than being on some sort of general industry. They were exclusive. Membership was not always easy to obtain in many cases, a little like today's equity union for actors. And their basic strategy for a long, very long period was to attempt to maximise wage levels and improve conditions, not by the kind of militant methods that we see in the modern period of large-scale striking and so on, but instead by the opposite tactic, by actually controlling from their own end the supply of labour, by trying to keep certain skills sufficiently scarce to enhance their value. What all of this added up to was a trade union movement which was very different from the one we think of today. And therefore, when in the 1880s new forms of unions started to emerge, it was a very exciting moment which carried many people by storm. The new unionism, as it's referred to in the 1880s, was a period in which, for the first time, much larger unions were formed, bridging many different trades but covering one broad industry, and following tactics altogether different, tactics which we associate with the modern period. Perhaps one most famous example of all of this was the 1889 Dockers strike, and there were many others, of course. This period of the 1880s, and a certain amount of trade union militancy, clearly itself was yet another reason, a sixth reason, from those I've mentioned, for capitalist class panic. It coincided, what's more, with something referred to by historians as the socialist revival, the reason being that there had been some small pockets of socialist or quasi-socialist organisation in the 1830s and 40s. And then there was a long, quiet period, relatively speaking, until the 1880s, in which there was a resurgence of broadly socialist organisation, or at least organisations calling themselves socialist, paying lip service to socialism, and in some cases genuinely adhering to the principles of socialism. One might mention in this regard the Social Democratic Federation, and indeed the Socialist League, which was formed in 1884. This period of relative militancy in the 1880s did produce this counter-reaction, and in fact there is a very clear tendency, a very clear trend, I should say, in the 1890s, to see an employer's counter-offensive in which there were a series of lockouts, a series of other actions by employers' federations, leading up to such famous cases as the Taft Vale judgment in the railways, in which the employers were clearly responding to and reacting to this wave of union organisation and trying to use anything in their power, including the power of the state and of legislation, in order to stamp out this rise of trade union activity. And to a large extent, the employers were relatively successful in so doing. Just to once again set the tone of this period of panic, let me quote from a book published in 1889 by somebody called G. Sims. The book was called How the Poor Live. And I quote briefly, he said, "This mighty mob of famished, diseased and filthy helots is getting dangerous, physically, morally, politically dangerous." So what then was the background to the legislation, which is the subject of today's talk, the Liberal Party's welfare legislation from 1906 to 1914? Well, faced with all of the reasons for panic, the politicians began to ponder. Joseph Chamberlain, speaking at an 1885 Liberal Party meeting, was discussing how to finance possible social services. He said, by way of challenging the capitalists to cough up some of the money for such services, "I ask what ransom will property pay for the security it enjoys?" Similarly, Lord Milner, speaking at Wolverhampton later on in 1906, said in his speech, "The attempt to raise the well-being and efficiency of the more backward of our people is not philanthropy, it is business." Now, these and many other quotations, some of which I'll mention later, give ample evidence for the assertion that the earliest origins of some kind of welfare state were very, very firmly seen by the ruling bodies of the day as being something which would preserve their property, something which would placate discontent. And there was very little mention, if indeed any, of such measures being radical, being changing of society, or in any sense being something which could ultimately serve the liberation of the working class. And so I think the message to draw from this is that any such notions which developed later on were in fact some kind of wishful thinking, which retrospectively look back at these measures and try to see in them the stepping stones to a new society. And they were simply not conceived that way, nor could they operate that way. The records which exist for the various chambers of commerce around the country can also be extremely revealing. These, after all, were the bodies of local capitalists, usually fairly substantial local capitalists, and they were their political and social meeting points. There was much discussion in this period of the kind of issues I've touched on. The Sheffield Chamber of Commerce voted in favour of compulsory military training after a 1908 speech by Lord Newton, which stated, "This will increase a man's efficiency as a wealth-producing machine." The Birmingham Chamber of Commerce Journal supported in 1905 the introduction of labour exchanges for workers who were described as assets of the nation. And Birmingham also urged the sternest measures for the wastrel and the loafer, in contrast. When he introduced the National Unemployment Insurance Scheme, which I mentioned in 1909, the precursor of the modern dole, Churchill, in his early days as a liberal, reassured employers that, and I quote, "The whole system will prove to be nothing more than wages spreading." Now, this is an assertion which socialists have sometimes returned to and indeed made ourselves, that the whole system of welfareism is in fact more a system for redistributing poverty than one for liberating the working class. And such assertions have sometimes been queried. But here you have it from the horse's mouth, from one of the earliest conceivers of such schemes. It was basically becoming increasingly clear to the ruling class that the relative decline of British imperial power was due, at least in part, to this unproductive state, this degenerate state of ill health into which workers had been driven by the needs of Victorian so-called prosperity. A series, for example, of minimum standards in food and accommodation were mooted to guarantee health, productivity and social stability. Now, I mentioned a moment ago the word efficiency as a wealth-producing machine. It features in the title of today's discussion. And I'd like to quote from The Spectator of the 14th of August, 1902, set tone for the age. They said, "At the present time, and perhaps it's the most notable social fact of this age, there is a universal outcry for efficiency in all the departments of society, in all the aspects of life." Gaston Rimlinger, in his 1971 study of the history of welfare policy, put this very well in saying, and I quote, "The workers' physical strength and goodwill had become important assets. Social insurance became one of the means of investing in human capital." Now, there's no doubt also that this preoccupation with the idea of efficiency, in some quarters, this obsession with the idea of efficiency, national efficiency, was also partly a reflection of the rise in scientific understanding throughout the 19th century, and an attempt increasingly to place human beings themselves within the domain and within the remit of this scientific scrutiny. Having said that, and having mentioned the role of science in this, the overriding impression, nevertheless, is that the kind of approaches we're dealing with were conditioned above all by a deep need and desire to maximise the profitability of British industry, of British capitalism, with the onset of the 20th century, and simply bringing scientific attitudes and ideas to bear within that aim. The attempt to use the state intervention to monitor the physical health of workers was also mirrored in this period by some rather clumsy early efforts to take control of the mental development of the working class, with the rise of the modern psychiatric profession in this period. Now, a particularly disturbing development at this time was the emergence of the eugenics movement, manifested by the Eugenic Society, which had some very reputable members. This was something in many ways of a precursor for the later rise of fascism, or at least some of the ideas which were touched on by the fascists. It was, interestingly enough, a movement which was supported by some of the leading Fabians of the day. The Fabian Society, which was later to become a supporter of the formation of the Labour Party, and which was to be regarded as supposedly socialist. This eugenics idea combined the suggestion of controlling the population growth in terms of who it would consist of, not just its size, together with the idea that the poorest in society were in fact genetically inferior and had to be wiped out. Now, in the 1911 article, again in the so-called respectable journal, which by now is called the 19th Century and After, because it was still publishing in the 20th century, Pearson wrote, as a supporter of eugenics, "Speaking broadly, pauperism, in other words, poverty and the dependence upon state handouts, is a token of the inferior capacity which belongs to an inferior stock. If the community is to be made responsible for the support of all its members, it must be entitled in self-defence to determine who its members shall be. In other words, we'll give you the dole, but if we decide you don't deserve it, we might just have to put your family's life to an end instead." Now, there were a number of people advocating, therefore, the termination of certain families, not by executing them, I hasten to add, but simply by a programme of enforced sterilisation of those families who were regarded as irresponsible, as too impoverished, badly behaved, to be allowed to reproduce. Now, it's easy for us to laugh at some of these things now, or to be bemused by them at least, but at the time this was taken pretty seriously, and let's face it, it was not that long ago. It's only, two or three generations ago that we're talking about. In the end, however, a policy of incarceration won the day rather than extermination, so that the Mental Deficiency Act 1913, 1 year before the end of the period we're looking at, was the first piece of modern legislation which provided for the classification and the enforced treatment of a whole range of people with alleged forms of mental defect and behavioural defect. And this included such categories as, and I quote, "idiots, imbeciles, feeble-minded persons," each of these categories being prescribed a different course of enforced treatment. According to official statistics, the numbers of these idiots, imbeciles and feeble-minded persons mysteriously grew rapidly in a very short period. Now, of course, this is more a question of the statistics than anything else, and the new definitions. But if you take it at face value, between 1879 and 1909, 30 years, the number of idiots grew from 2.44 for every 1,000 to 3.66 for every 1,000. Now that's something like a 50% increase in the number of idiots in a period of one generation, according to the nonsense which was being peddled by these would-be early scientists. And I suppose it's a little unfair for us to mock them too harshly. Human development is all about one generation learning from the stupidity and mistakes of earlier generations. What would be less forgivable, of course, is if people in the present generation are tempted towards some of the notions of psychiatric labelling, which this, in fact, was the beginning of. The Act in question also made a concession to the Eugenics Society in its specific provision for moral defectives, whose mental defect was compounded by strong vicious or criminal propensities. Vicious not necessarily meaning violent, but meaning that of having vices. Vicious or criminal propensities on which punishment had little or no effect. They would be incarcerated, they would be subjected to treatments, which in some cases were extremely brutal. Despite the beginnings of this pretense to medical authority on the part of the nascent psychiatric profession, the determination of such conditions was clearly social in nature and political in nature rather than medical. For example, the Act refers to these people as being unable to guard against common dangers, in other words, unable to deal with the problems of society. And they spoke about the potential inmates as having failures of self-sufficiency. In other words, workers who found it difficult to manage could be labelled in these ways. Now, that all of these reforms that I've touched on, such as national insurance for workers in 1909, pensions in 1908, this mental health efforts in 1913, the fact that all of these reforms were an expression of a large-scale capitalist interest can be proven from the fact, and I stress a large capitalist interest, in other words, the big capitalists saw this as being in their interest to improve efficiency. We can see the fact that some of the smaller employers were not quite so confident as their bigger brother capitalists. The 1911 National Insurance Act was actually opposed by a group of small employers, particularly based in the Lancashire textiles. They formed something called the Employers' Parliamentary Association, and they argued that it was necessary to oppose the National Insurance Act on the grounds that the initial costs would outweigh the long-term advantages. In other words, they felt nervous about the fact that some expense might fall upon their small budgets. But in contrast to that, in stark contrast, the Association of Chambers of Commerce, which represented the rather more substantial capitalists, had no hesitation in supporting these measures as being in their long-term concrete interest to have an efficient and hard-working labour force. So much for the efforts of capitalists to organise capitalism and to placate the majority in society. How did the working class respond to all of this? Well, reaction was split two ways. There were those who saw through these attempts to patch up a rotten system. There were those who insisted, in other words, on its overthrow. And on the other hand, there were those who entered into an unholy alliance with their masters, seeking to streamline their own exploitation. Now, we saw, therefore, the formation, on the one hand, of the Socialist Party of Great Britain in 1904 on a platform of no compromise. And then 2 years later, the formation of the Labour Party on a platform of nothing but compromise. So far to date, the Labour Party and the general attitude it embodies has won the battle of numbers. It's about all they have won, relatively to the Socialist Party and the Socialist movement. Clearly, the past 80 years, it cannot be denied that the Labour Party, in particular, has enjoyed a certain amount of numerical support. It's worth adding, of course, that in recent years, and indeed recent decades, that numerical support has fallen extremely rapidly. In fact, in the years since the Second World War, the number of people who belong to the Labour Party or who actively support the Labour Party has in fact been virtually decimated. It has fallen by thousands year by year, almost without exception. So I don't want to stress too much the strength of the Labour Party. What I would say, however, the Labour Party at the time won the numerical battle and was therefore able eventually to form one or two, several governments in fact. However, that numerical victory on the part of compromise has shown just one thing. It's shown the uselessness of trying to reform capitalism as a way to really liberating workers. It means that these programmes of patching up the system have now been introduced, on the one hand, by capitalists who, far from being benevolent capitalists, were actually extremely hard-headed, as I've shown from their quotes, very business-minded. They've introduced such measures in order to improve efficiency of exploitation. Later on in the 20th century, we've had people in the name of the working class trying to introduce similar measures, claiming that they could, in fact, be liberating measures. And in both cases, the results have been absolutely abysmal, without exception. There has been no sign at all of real working class liberation as a result of any of these efforts. In the words of the Liberal leader, Balfour, when he defended the 1906-14 Liberal government's laying down of the foundations for the later so-called welfare state, he was very clear. He said, "Social legislation is not merely to be distinguished from socialist legislation, but it is its most direct opposite and its most effective antidote." Once again, from the horse's mouth, the leader of the party which first introduced these reform measures says that they are there as the direct opposite of real social revolution. Incidentally, as a passing footnote, I mentioned the Socialist League a little earlier as being a socialist organisation of the 1880s. In many ways, it was remarkably similar to the later Socialist Party, which is responsible for running the meeting today, which was formed 20 years later. Not just in its object and its principles, but even in its organisation. When it was founded in 1884, the Socialist League founders, 10 people who contributed to the founding of the Socialist League, produced a statement in 1884 in which they said, "We believe that to hold out as baits hopes of amelioration of the condition of the workers, to be wrung out of the necessities of the rival factions of the privileged rulers, is delusive and mischievous. In the present state of things, socialist propaganda has no function but to educate the people in the principles of socialism." That stress on education, the urgent need for political education, is something the Socialist Party thoroughly endorses. And equally, that condemnation of the political gameplay of setting one group of capitalists against another, and indeed setting workers against one another, and playing games with the system to try to wring petty reforms and minor changes out of it, when the real battle is still to be won. We would also share the condemnation of those tactics. A report the following year on the Socialist League journal, which was called The Commonweal, spoke of a print run of between 2,000 and 3,500 copies each month, and complained, and I quote, "There is a great supineness on the part of members in pushing sales. A few do good work, but it needs that all should do so. Everybody should canvass for subscriptions, spread leaflets, and back numbers." I just mentioned that as a little bit of advice which possibly some people present may like to take heed of as well, even though it's many years later. Let me finish my comments then by just a very brief example of the legacy today of these developments in the history of capitalism between 1880 and 1914, because most of the trends and problems I've touched on are still entirely relevant and very much with us today. And in particular, I would pinpoint the way in which the capitalist class, the small minority in society, who actually own and control all of the productive resources, are still very concerned to enhance the efficiency with which they organise the legalised robbery of the majority in society. I say legalised robbery because, of course, it's the 90% who have to work for wages or salaries who create all of the wealth in society, and yet we are the ones who, receiving those wages or salaries, are never quite receiving the value of the wealth we're creating. There is always a surplus in the form of profit which is being accumulated, which is helping to build up the capital of that minority we work for. And therefore there is this central problem in society which is not simply iniquitous, but is iniquitous. It is not simply something which is very iniquitous to the interest of the majority, but in fact it is a crisis right at the very heart of human society, which prevents us from solving the most basic human problems of hunger and pollution, comfort, alienation, and many other problems which affect us. But still, there is this process of people being transformed into commodities and having to be sold on the labour market. In 1985, exactly 100 years after many of the other quotations I've given, a document was produced by the government trying to sell British workers to the rest of the world. It's called Britain, the Preferred Location. It was prepared by the Department of Trade and Industry and the Central Office of Information, and I quote from it as follows. "Not only does Britain's workforce perform well, its costs are remarkably low for what is one of the world's most highly developed countries. Wage rates are among the lowest in the Western world. In addition, on costs, i.e. those labour costs which are additional to wages, such as state social security schemes and the financing of voluntary sick and pension schemes, are very low in Britain. You will find the British workforce of today disciplined, motivated, skilled, and ready for work. Well, what I want to urge you to do, in fact, is to prove them perhaps right in one sense and wrong in another. Let's prove that we are ready for work, but not quite the work they had in mind for us. If we're ready for work, let's use all of the resources at our disposal, and they're very great. We're talking here about the great majority in society. Let's use those resources to end the system that we've been looking at. End the system in which wealth is produced in order to be sold for a profit in the marketplace. And create instead a democratic system of society in which wealth is produced purely and directly to satisfy human needs. A socialist system, worldwide, democratically created, democratically run, in which we have production for use, not profit. Production to meet human needs, not to meet the needs of the market, the needs of profit, or the needs of capital accumulation and finance. Those are things which do not affect the majority of people except in a negative way, and therefore should be dispensed with.